So welcome everybody to this short retreat, and please know that if for some reason you need to go outside for the toilet or something, you're always welcome. I always say that the Sangha, the monks and the nuns, we should be the most difficult people to give offence to. Because there are sometimes, if you need to go to the toilet, you have to go. In Buddhism, we call going to the toilet a very nice practice of kindness and letting go. So we don't even call it the toilet in my monastery, we call it the letting go room. And it's also being kind to your body. Sometimes, if you don't respect your body, and you give it too much like training, treating it like a dog you have to train, sometimes your body just rebels against you. When it does rebel against you, it causes you all sorts of trouble, you know, health problems and also emotional problems as well. And that's one of the reasons why that if any of you ever do study the Buddha suttas, we have something called the Eightfold Path, and the second factor of the Eightfold Path is called Sammasankappa. Often people translate that as right intention. I prefer to call it right motivation, because it details where you are coming from, not where you are going to. And if you look at that, the three right motivations are motivations coming from a place of letting go, of renunciation, patinissaka. And the next one, I think, is the most important, avayapada, which is non-ill will, but it's used as a simile for kindness. When I became a Buddhist as a young student at high school, it was the kindness and the compassion of Buddhism which inspired me the most. And then when I looked in the Eightfold Path, I was looking for where's the right kindness. At first I couldn't see it mentioned. But then when I learnt Pali, and it's very similar to Latin, I had a good brain, I could do that. And when I learned Pali, to see that this actually was included in the second factor of the second part of the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. It was right kindness. And the third part of Sammasankappa was gentleness, vihingsaka, which is the same as ahingsaka. And many people know the word ahimsa, you know, from the work of Gandhi in India, and the path of non-violence, of gentleness. And I think you all know that those of you who've known monks or nuns before, or who've come here and seen the Venerable Monk here, that you know the monks and nuns are very gentle. We don't hurt people. Unfortunately, that sometimes people forget those teachings. And I know that on some Zen retreats, sometimes the Zen master handles a big stick and whacks people over the back. I could never understand what that has got to do with Buddhism. But I do remember going to Hong Kong once, and in Hong Kong, it was a meeting place between many monks and nuns of many different traditions. And one day in the afternoon I was having tea with a senior monk of the Mahayana tradition, or the Zen tradition, who had his monastery or knew about monasteries in mainland China. And he said he knew of this one Zen retreat which happened in mainland China a few years ago, where the Zen master walked behind everybody and if anybody was sleepy, he would hit them over the back with the Zen stick. You may think that's traditional, but the middle-aged woman he hit over the back with a Zen stick immediately took out her mobile, this is not an exaggeration, took out her mobile phone and called the police. And the police came and took that monk away. And that was the end of that retreat. You can't do that. And there's a good reason why we don't do that. Our main reason, it's not really part of Buddhism. There's no gentleness there. There's no kindness. And there's a much, much better way to practice meditation, a non-violent way. Why is it we teach non-violence in some areas, but we can be very violent to our body when we do meditation? So a quick introduction to meditation. This is not forcing your body into stillness and the insight which arises from stillness. It is kindly letting your body slow down and become still. I'm not quite sure how many of you have seen me teach on YouTube. I know some of you have come from many different countries and not all from Oslo. How many of you are not Norwegians? Oh my goodness, almost a third of you. So anyway, those who live here may not have seen me use this simile. You don't have many visual aids when you're teaching as a monk, but this is one of the best visual aids. This glass of water. Now if my job, my goal, was to keep this glass of water perfectly still, how do I make this water perfectly still? Ajahnita, you're sitting so close and I've known you for so many years. Has it become still yet? Be honest.
No way.
No way, okay. So now, the reason why it wasn't becoming still, I wasn't mindful. Now I'll be mindful of the water. Has it become still yet?
Nope.
Okay, what am I doing wrong? I'm not concentrating, am I? So now I will be mindful and concentrate. Has it become still?
Nope.
It's actually, when I do this seriously and try and concentrate, it actually moves more. Try it for yourself. So many people have meditated for a long time, sometimes several years, and they still haven't achieved any stillness. And they think they can't meditate. But they don't understand the method and how to meditate. So how can I get this water to be perfectly still? Yes, you see me before. You put it down. You relax. You let go. You're not attached. Leave it alone. Renounce. Now, is that water, Ajahnita, has it got more still?
No, it's still.
There we go. And I didn't do anything. I disappeared and let it go. That's a simple simile, but it is very powerful. When you meditate, do you try to calm the mind? Do you use your effort and force? Come on, mind, be still. Do you ever experience stillness? So what we need to do is learn how to put things down, let it go, and then stillness happens all by itself. And that's a simile which I've used, but Ajahn Chah, my meditation teacher in Thailand, he used a different simile. I cannot use it in here because this is night time, the windows are closed, and you can't see any of the bushes or trees outside. But if you could see those bushes, those trees in the forest or in the gardens, the leaves on those trees, if they were moving, why? It must be there's a wind blowing. And if that wind stopped, or if you protected that bush or that tree from the wind, those leaves would still move, only less and less and less, until because of friction, those leaves would eventually stop moving altogether. You didn't hold the leaves still, you just protected them from the wind which makes them move. So if you want to experience stillness in meditation, how does that happen? What actually do you put down for it to be still? Ajahn Chah explained, it is the winds of wanting. That's what makes your mind move. You want something, or you want to get rid of something. And because of those winds of wanting, that's why your mind moves. If you stop wanting things, if you stop not wanting things, if you gave up just for a small few moments of time, maybe longer than that, a few minutes of time, gave up all wanting, you'll find your mind would move less and less and less, easily, naturally, because the state of stillness is actually a default mode of your mind. When you don't want anything, there's nothing to make the mind move, and stillness comes naturally, just like that glass of water. But so what? You're still. Then what happens? Once we have stillness, and stillness is the accurate translation of samadhi. You may have heard that word before. Some people translate it as concentration. And that is not just an erroneous translation, but a very dangerous translation. It does not mean that. If it did mean concentration, then what would this, like, retreat be? It would be a concentration camp. And straight away, you know, there's a lot of difference between the kindness and the softness and the gentleness of stillness, which you don't have when you have concentration. You get to a similar result. That is so still, it doesn't move. It's like the mind is focused, but it's not done through force. You're not making it happen. You are letting it happen, going to the default state of the mind. So this is actually how we achieve and experiences wonderful stillness. I don't know if you've had experiences of stillness either in meditation or maybe in most unexpected places, you may have been in the forest. But I do recall one of my anecdotes many years ago, I think maybe about 43 years ago, I think it was, that one of the monasteries in UK was purchased in the little village of Chithurst. And I went to visit. The main reason for visiting was actually to visit my family. I was born in London, and so I thought the best time to visit my family was at Christmas time, when everybody would come together. So the days before, I visited this monastery of our tradition over in England. And that year was extremely cold. And it was, I think, minus 16, I think, or it could have been minus 26, but many degrees below freezing. That may not mean much to people in Norway because, you know, you've adapted to extremely cold weather. But places like Sussex, that was so cold, it basically shut the country down for 24 hours. No cars could run on the roads. There was no aircraft up in the sky. And when I, because I was a visitor, I could actually go for a walk in the forest. But even, because I had no duties to do. But I was the only one, people would say, mad enough to actually to go into such cold weather, you know, for a walk in the morning when there was snow and freezing everywhere. And of course, all the birds were hibernating, the same with all the little animals who lived underground. I was the only living thing outside of bed that time of the morning. Everybody else was inside somewhere. And that was such a wondrous memory. When I'm telling you this, I'm recalling it because it was almost seared into my memory. It was so peaceful, so cold, but incredibly, perfectly still. I had boots on. When I stopped crunching the snow under my boots, there was no sound to be heard at all in that forest. It was perfect stillness. There's no wind, no cars, no sound of human beings, no animals. It was perfect silence. And that silence, the joy of it and the magic of it, the inspiration of silence, very easily overwhelmed the feeling of such freezing cold on my body and on my feet. I just didn't want to miss this opportunity to drink in the silence more and more and more. Have you experienced moments of silence like that? Silence is delightful, refreshing. Of course, these days, I don't seek for silence in snowfields. I seek for the silence, especially in caves. I love caves. I live in a cave. There's no natural caves in the monastery in Western Australia where I live. So we built one. Only a small cave. And many of you have seen it. Have you been in that cave? Have you not, Ajahnito? My cave. Yeah. And it's perfectly quiet. Sometimes there may be a thunderstorm outside. I can't hear it. There's no lights in there. There is a beautiful, very soft flow of air, which, you know, through some pipes, and that keeps it well aired and ventilated. But you can't hear anything. You can't see anything. And it's totally a place of renunciation. It's warm. We've even got electricity in there. I'm a softie. But I love it in there because it's so quiet. And that silence, that stillness, just by itself, is very joyful. The beautiful sound of peace. We think too much. Because we think too much, we see too little. There's the usual story which I say is of Lao Tzu. And Lao Tzu, when he was alive in China, that he would go for a walk every evening with one of his students. But if you were selected to go on a walk with the great master, you had this golden rule, you had to keep silent. you were not allowed to speak or say anything. If you've heard this story before, please know that I've heard it more times than you, every time I teach it. But the reason why I teach it is because I do not know a better description, number one, of what silence is, and why we're silent, and what happens when we're silent, than this old story. So he had this young man who went on this walk with him, and when they got to a ridge in the mountains, maybe an hour or two's walk from the monastery, that is when they saw this amazing, gorgeous sunset. And the young man who was on the walk with the master couldn't help himself. He said, "What a beautiful sunset. There's lovely golds and crimsons stretching along the horizon." Fortunately, the place where I live, again in Western Australia, it's on the edge of a range of hills which overlook, you know, maybe 20 kilometers in the distance, the Indian Ocean. There are some amazing sunsets there whenever you want to watch them. See the sun over 30 or 40 kilometers of coast. And sometimes when it's a bit, some smoke from fires or some clouds on the horizon, there are some of the most gorgeous sunsets there. I know what a gorgeous sunset looks like. But this student said what a beautiful sunset that was. And Lao Tzu turned around and walked back to his monastery. He couldn't say to that student that he'd broken the rule. If he had, then Lao Tzu would have also broken the rule. That's like those three monks in the cave. There's actually four monks in the cave. First monk sneezed, another monk said, "Bless you." Second monk said, "You've broken your vow of silence." Third monk said, "So have you." And the fourth monk said, "I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet." That's an old joke, but I'm sure you appreciate it. When Lao Tzu got back to his temple, then he told that monk that he could never go on a walk with the master ever again. That was such a severe penalty that all the young student's friends tried to intervene. Why is so severe? And that's when the Zen master said, and this was the most important part of the story, when my student said, "What a beautiful sunset," he was not watching the sunset anymore. He was watching the words. When I read that, it hit me very strongly. If you are thinking about something, you are watching the description of that thing. You're not really experiencing it deeply. Which is one of the reasons why, if you ever see a beautiful scene of nature, a landscape, a sunset, or the stars at night, if you even hear that beautiful music, you can't think about it. Otherwise, you miss the notes coming next. This is one of the reasons why you appreciate life with more accuracy, more fully. You just feel it, you see it, you hear it, you taste it, without the commentary. You see it in silence. And of course, there's many fascinating and jovial things about this. Once, when I was on an aircraft, as a monk, we're not allowed to watch movies. But then, when I was on this aircraft, this screen came down right in front of me, and they were showing a movie. And I never had any headphones. I never asked for any headphones. I found out afterwards the movie was called Armageddon. Do you remember that movie? It was like these stupid, please excuse me, these two stupid white Americans saving the world. And of course they had to fight. Instead of actually, you know, doing their job and saving the world, you know, just competing against each other. But anyway, the scene which I remember, without any sound, I didn't know what the dialogue was, when one of these heroes, their spacecraft hit this meteor or something which was headed directly to planet Earth. And they hit it at such great velocity, and there was bangs and sparks and flames for about 5 minutes of the movie. And then it went quiet. Now that would be enough to destroy anybody with the whole craft as well. And then it fell off a cliff. And the sparks and the flames and explosions happened all over again for another 5 minutes. They'd totally destroy any human being. But then everything went quiet, and you could see on part of the spacecraft a hand came up and pulled himself up from the floor. And as one of these heroes, he'd survived. Not just survived, even his hair was perfect. No sweat on his face, no bruises, no scratches, nothing. And I burst out laughing. It was absolutely crazy. But all the other people sitting next to me, whew, he made it. They were relieved. So what I'm saying though, the reason I said that simile, is because the background music and the commentary, they make you see this world in a totally different way. If you're silent, you can see so much more, so much stupidity, so much wisdom sometimes, so much more depth, but most importantly, more accuracy. It's much more true to the world than when you're thinking. It's called the wisdom born of silence. People always assume they have to think to be able to know the truth. Thinking is actually what is deceptive. Silence is where you can see the truth so much more accurately. An example of that, an example we use so often in all types of Buddhism, if you go up into the mountains on a full moon night, and the sky is clear. If you can find a lake in that mountain, then see if you can see the reflection of the moon and the stars in that quiet, unruffled mountain lake. Because when there's no wind or there's nothing making that water move, the surface of that water becomes like a mirror. A small ripple means the mirror is distorted, or the image in the mirror is distorted. But when it's perfectly still, you get the best image of the moon and the stars in the heavens around you. That's a story which I've used many times. But I was also fascinated when I gave some talks in South Korea to see that one of the leaders of the Jogje order was also using the same simile. It's a common simile in our meditative traditions. The best way to see the truth is as a reflection in a still forest pool of your mind. When you're still, you can see accurately, without distortion. As the Buddha said, from stillness, samadhi is the cause for seeing things as they truly are, undistorted. So in a meditation retreat like this, we do have noble silence. So please, try not to talk too much. And the best is not to talk much at all. Noble silence is different than ordinary silence, because sometimes if you are silent, sometimes that you may see a danger somewhere. Somebody is about to trip over something. In such situation, compassion and wisdom has to rule over silence. You tell somebody, look out, there's a stick there you can trip over. But you don't have a conversation. And if somebody else is chatting too much, please, you don't have to tell them, you shouldn't be chatting, we're keeping noble silence, you should know this, you've been coming here for years, don't talk so much. You've already started talking. So if you see somebody else disturbing that noble silence, please give them the one finger sign. You know what the one finger sign is? You've heard me before, haven't you? Yeah? Sometimes people think that's the middle finger, which is very rude. Don't do that. It is. Which reminds everybody to try and keep quiet. So that stillness, when you come in here, it creates almost like a sense of peace and holiness and sacredness inside this hall here, the meditation hall. The energy does build up. In the meditation hall in the monastery in Perth where I live, which I built, it's got so much stillness in it that even a Feng Shui master came many years ago and he said after he left, it's got some of the strongest Feng Shui he's ever seen in his life, simply because of the stillness which we've built in that place. Stillness like soaks in to the floor and the walls and everywhere. Even once a builder who was building our water tanks, he was a concrete worker, a granite worker, a rough diamond, really strong, very tough Australian, always talking, and he asked if he could, at the end of the job of building these big concrete water tanks, he said, I'm not a Buddhist, but would you mind if I come and see your church? It was not a church, it was a meditation hall, but that's how he described it. So yeah, sure. So I took him into the hall. He had his big boots smeared with concrete and mud. He said, do I have to take them off? I said, no, just pull your head around the corner into the hall. And I always remember that experience because he was talking so much, but as soon as his head came inside the hall, he went quiet. And the hall silenced him. And after about 1 or 2 minutes, he took his head out and said, oh, this is great, isn't it, Brahm? He was this rough diamond of a worker, of a builder, for the first time probably in his life, could allow that stillness to come into his heart and mind. He enjoyed it so much. So first of all, with stillness, it gives you a lot of joy. And don't demean that. Secondly, it gives you the wisdom. You start to see things you've never seen before, feel things you've never felt before, understand things you've never felt before. The stillness empowers your mindfulness. It makes it stronger. I don't know that as a monk, I've been a monk over 48 years now, so this was before the mindfulness movement in the West even began. And so when I learned what mindfulness was, it was far deeper and more powerful than what I hear these days is taught in clubs and societies and groups and things. The mindfulness is empowered by stillness. And it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. If anybody wants to check me out, that is from the Nalakarpana Sutta. In that teaching of the Buddha, he said, if you experience those deep stillnesses, which we call the jhanas, then after you emerge from those states, not only is these five hindrances which distort your mind disappear for a long time, but also discontent and weariness, tiredness disappear for a long time. In other words, it's like you've taken your mindfulness to the garage and it's been tuned up. It's been souped up, I think they used to call it, in the old cars. And it's really powerful now. Oh, the windows have been cleaned so you can see out of them with just much more clarity. Everything sparkles so much more. And I hope that you can experience this even on this short weekend meditation retreat. It happens that when you are meditating, you've had a nice, quiet meditation, and you open your eyes, you see the wooden floor in front of you. You can see just how amazingly beautiful it is. It's not just like seeing it with your ordinary eyes. It's like the colors become clearer, the patterns become more and more balanced, beautiful, inspiring or whatever. Of course, I can only give personal examples of this because the personal examples are just the most powerful for me. And I remember many, many times the first meditation retreat which I ever did was as a 19-year-old. It was in Cambridge where I studied, and we were allowed to go for a walk every morning for 1 hour and then come back again for the breakfast. So when I went for a walk for that hour, because I knew my way around that city, I would go to the botanical gardens. I thought, you know, it's an obvious place to go to. But you know, I only got to the entrance way of those botanical gardens. It was about 10 minutes walk from the retreat center, maybe 5 minutes. When I got to that entrance, there was a clump of bamboo at this entrance. And I must have seen it before, but this time it looked the most beautiful, delightful bamboo clump I'd ever seen in my life. It looked amazing. And I could not help myself but standing there and staring at it in wonder. I had enough presence of mind to notice there was a bench seat. And I knew that if I had kept on just standing there, gazing at it for 50 minutes, which is what I did, then somebody would have called the doctors and have taken me away in an ambulance thinking I was taking drugs and got crazy. It's not the normal thing you do in UK to stand there watching a clump of bamboo in the early morning. I don't know if they do that in Norway. Do you have any bamboo in Norway? But you shouldn't have it in Cambridge. It's really cold and windy. But nevertheless, that bamboo looked delightful, and I couldn't take my eyes away from it. And I visited it again the next day and the next day and the next day. 8 of the 9 days of the retreat, I went to the most beautiful clump of bamboo I'd ever seen in the world. And bamboo is beautiful. They use it in Chinese watercolors a lot. But anyway, after the retreat was over, I went back to studies and being busy, my social life. You know what it's like being a 20-year-old, or 19-year-old, sorry. When I went back to all of that, I remember having a free afternoon with nothing to do. So I thought I'd get on my bicycle and go to the botanical gardens and visit the most beautiful clump of bamboo in the world once more. But what I saw, it was that same clump of bamboo, but now it was dry, it was just really weak, it was struggling to survive in the cold weather of that city. Bamboo did not belong there. And what really struck me was, where had the beauty gone? The delight. I could watch that for hours, almost 8 days on a run. Now I looked at it and it was just so ordinary, actually misplaced in a climate like that. And that taught me that when I was meditating, when the mind was still, it could see so much more than you can see when you're busy thinking and tired. And that's what I was now, back to my social life. It taught me what real mindfulness is. Is that sometimes, as I say, you open your eyes and you can see the wood on the floor. It's absolutely gorgeous. Not just that, but even the food. Whatever you eat here, you eat at home. It becomes more delicious. Your mind is getting empowered. You can see more. And it's also, you have much more fun. It's weird. People sometimes feel that any spiritual life must be very tough. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do something else. It's always no, 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 no. But, you know, hopefully that you look at a monk like me or some of the other monks here and they're very happy. Why? It's because, you know, through the meditation you get this energy in the mindfulness. Whatever you see deeper into it. And what you see deeper into it, becomes more delightful, more beautiful, more wonderful. You're changing your perceptions. So during this retreat, I hopefully that you can become still enough, your mindfulness increases. When it increases in its power, you do things like watching your body, being aware of your body. Sometimes you feel, that must be a terrible thing to do, spend an hour just looking at your own body, especially if you're old. I tell my monks, I used to tell the monks when Ajahn Nito was there, that I'm getting old. And they were such kind monks over in Australia. They said, Ajahn Brahm, you're not getting old. I said, thank you. You're already old. But even though you're already old, still, you can have so much happiness and joy. One of the other things, I mean, I don't know if I should claim this, but, you know, for the last 31 years, that I haven't had any illnesses, which is weird. No COVID, no any other sicknesses. And at that time, many monks in Bodhinyana Monastery, where I live, get sick. The only time I've ever seen our local doctor was actually to take another monk to see him. And it's weird. How come you have such great health? It's because you get to know your body. You're kind to your body. And that understanding your body gives a great deal of health benefits. And a good example of that is that, do you really know your body? Are you a friend to it? Or you try and train it? Are you scared of it? And I mention that not as underestimating. How can you be scared of your own body? Sometimes we are. Sometimes we want to train our body. It may have a headache. We don't want it to have a headache. We have like a feeling in our chest. Is that a heart attack coming? You get a sort of tension on your breasts. Is that a breast cancer coming? I teach twice a year the cancer groups in Western Australia. This big organization, they call themselves Solaris, used to be the Cancer Care Association. And I've been teaching for the last about 40 years there, every year. And when they got a grant from the local government to build this huge complex with many, many sort of buildings and many sort of support mechanisms for those with cancer, at the opening, the grand opening of a multi-million dollar project, they had the Premier of Western Australia, the head politician there. He was the first of the dignitaries for the opening ceremony. And me. And I asked, you know, what about the Archbishop or some other big dignitary? And they said, no, we've invited you as our second dignitary, because you've helped us so much over those years. So what have I done? You taught us that mindfulness and how to be aware of your body. But it's just not mindfulness alone. It's what we call kindfulness. It's a word I coined when I was in Hong Kong many years ago, adding kindness to the mindfulness, which makes it much easier to be aware. When you're kind to something, it's easier to focus on that. If you have a cat or a dog or some sort of pet in the house, if you have a kid, a son, a daughter, that kindness comes so easily. You love being with them. And because you love being with them, you don't have to focus your attention by force. The things you love and care for draw your attention to them. So the kindfulness makes it easy to focus and keep your attention there. That's one of the reasons through kindfulness, your mindfulness does increase. You see so much more, and what you see is easy. Many years ago, when I taught meditation over in Malaysia, was the first time that people complained about samadhi meditation headache. And that shocked me and disappointed me. How can you have headaches when you're meditating? I meditate to understand headaches and to get past them. It's amazing what this meditation can do. It's the same when you have a feeling in your chest or something. What is that? And sometimes it's like almost like a pre-cancer. Your body is actually telling you that it needs some help. One of the nicest things to do is just be kind. There was an example. There was this student who was studying in Adelaide University. And she had chronic anxiety disorder, which meant that she felt so scared and panicked, she couldn't even get out of her bed in the morning. And being a student at a university in Australia, she could get free, you know, GP visits, psychologists, psychiatrists, anything. She had the best free care. But nothing was working. She couldn't get out of her bed or get out of the door and go to her lessons. And fortunately, she had a very lovely boyfriend, Lloyd, who who would look after her, feed her, wash, keep her sort of happy. And anyway, that this lady, she had good fortune, that her uncle in Perth was one of my disciples. So he asked me, please, can you help her? So I didn't do chanting and stuff. Instead, I asked her. I phoned her in her bed and asked her, when you have an anxiety attack, where do you feel it in your body? Because I know that any emotion has a counterpart feeling in your body. Not how your mind feels it, but how your body feels it. And she said she felt it in her chest. I said, that's not good enough. Exactly where do you feel it in your chest? Now, you're a scientist, and she was, studying science and at that time. And I said, I want coordinates from your belly button, your navel. How many centimetres and millimetres up? How far it spreads in your chest area? And she had nothing else to do. She was in bed all the time. It gave her something to do. I said, give me a call in 3 days when you can give me an accurate description, this counterpart feeling of anxiety, where you feel it in your body. She did that. 3 days, she gave this wonderful description. And then I said, well, that's good, but how does the feeling, how does it feel like? Is it burning? Is it tense? Is it sort of throbbing? Does it come and go? How does it feel? She gave, well, it kind of hurts. That's not good enough. Give me another call in 3 days. I was giving her something to do. One of the most important parts of this was that she took control over her treatment. Instead of just telling her what to do, she had to find out something. She had a job to do for her good health. And so after 3 days she gave this wonderful description. She's a very intelligent girl. And then I said, wonderful, you now have mindfulness of that panic attack. You're aware of it, you know, quite in detail. Now, I said, the next thing I want you to do is to be kind. So take your hand, whenever you have a panic attack, take your hand and massage that area of your body where the anxiety attack is. And I said, I was always a bit cheeky and naughty, if you can't do it, get your boyfriend Lloyd to do it. I'm sure he wouldn't complain. And so I said, yeah. And I said, give me a call in 3 days. And so she did that. And after 3 days, she said, yeah, I massaged that area with kindness. I said, what happened to the counterpart feeling to anxiety? She said, well, after massaging it, the physical feeling disappeared. So what about the cause of that counterpart feeling in your chest, the actual anxiety? What did that do? And this, again, one of those experiences I'll never forget. You call it the light bulb moment. She paused. And she said, when I massaged you, when the counterpart feeling went, the anxiety went as well. I said, well done. Now you know how to treat your anxiety yourself. And then what happened next? Another week, she was out of the bed, back to studies. She did really well. She got her first class honours. And then eventually she called me again. Can you be in Perth on this particular day? Because that her boyfriend Lloyd and her were getting married. And so I did the marriage blessing for both of them, for Lloyd and Jippy. They've got about 3 kids now. It worked. And that's an example of the power that mindfulness can have if you know how to use it well and add the kindness to it. So in the meditation we're going to be doing here for a couple of days, when you're aware of your body when you start meditating, please add the kindness. The second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. the second factor of the Eightfold Path, that the kindness there, the gentleness, and the first part of the Sammasankappa is letting go, renunciation. You know what that means? It's something which Ajahn Chah would always say to the monks when they were meditating, to everybody when they were meditating. You're not meditating to achieve something. You're meditating to let go of things. See how much you can disappear. Not, how many things have you got in your life? You want more things? Okay, the story of the... I know that Venerable Chanda's been with me for the last couple of weeks, so she's heard this story a couple of times. Ajahn Nito has got a good memory. He's heard this story many times, but neither of them have heard this story as many times as I have. But it was the story of this Sri Lankan lady who came to visit her children in the city of Colombo. And, you know, Sri Lanka, she was a devout Buddhist, and after a while, they got a bit bored. How can you look after, you know, their auntie, their grandma? They loved her, but they had to go to work and they had to do stuff. So they came up with this wonderful idea that there was a retreat center close by. And they said, "Grandma, auntie, do you like to go on a retreat? We'll pay for everything." And this wonderful retreat center. And it wasn't a retreat like this. There that you meditated and you were taught the Dhamma and you studied it. And it was something like about 30 or 45 days. At the end of that retreat, the people teaching it would interview you, almost like giving you a test to find out what you understood and how you understood it and how the meditation was. And if you did really well, they'd give you a certificate. And at the end of this retreat, they announced to this Sri Lankan auntie that you've done extremely well, auntie, amazingly well, that we've discussed your understanding of the Dhamma, your depth of meditation, and we all conclude unanimously that you are on the first stage of enlightenment. You are a stream winner. Now that's a huge event in a person's life, becoming a stream winner. It means you're destined to enlightenment, full enlightenment. And you can't go and get reborn in a lower realm. So they said this and they were just so taken aback by this old lady getting angry at them. "Why are you angry at us, auntie? This is an amazing thing which you've done. You're a stream winner. And we've got a certificate to give to you confirming this." And the auntie looked at them, you know, with so much anger that only an old auntie can do. And said, "You don't remember me, do you?" "No. I was here about 5 years ago. And you said I was a non-returner, two stages higher. You've demoted me." And of course you can't demote anybody. It was like a scam. And she had found them out. And that centre apparently closed a couple of years afterwards. We're not meditating to get certificates. We're meditating to let go of things, to be more free. To be more free of our sense of self and ownership. That's what's going to disappear. You don't own those beautiful visions of the bamboo. You have to let them go. This is just our life. Being clear, aware, and seeing things disappear. That becomes an introduction to the meditation. Sometimes people get scared when I teach meditation this way. But don't be. It's only scared because it's like the simile of someone who's been in prison, lived all their life in jail, never knowing anything else but jail. Because they lived all their life in jail, they go to school in jail, and they do really well, they study hard and get all these degrees in jail. Bachelor's degrees, master's degrees. I don't know why they don't call it mistress degrees for female. That's a silly joke. Or a PhD. You know what a PhD means? What does a PhD mean? It means permanent head damage. But anyway, that after a while, we learn that all those things, all those degrees which you learnt when you were young, you forget them all. They're not important. But the peace and the stillness, and the joy and the happiness, the sense of freedom, that's what will stay with you for your life. So this is the type of meditation which gives you wisdom. But if you're born in jail and done all your studies in jail, you know nothing else but jail. You know what happens next? The people find a nice partner to hook up with in jail. And they share the prison cell. They work very hard to get a bigger prison cell than other prisoners. They think they're beginning to make it in the world. And they're the front page of all the magazines in jail. And they think that they're making something in jail. They have all these certificates of all the wonderful things they've done in jail. And all the kids they've had in jail. They never know what's outside of jail. And then one day, someone says, there's a huge amount beyond those five prison walls. Those five prison walls was the wall of sight, sound, smell, taste, and a physical touch. Beyond that wall, there's a huge, like a beautiful garden. And in this meditation, we'll try and entice you to go outside of that prison for a few minutes. To have like a few minutes of day release. And when you come outside of that jail and see what's outside in the deep meditations beyond your five senses in the realm of the mind, you realize something else in life. Peaceful, beautiful, wonderful, the deep meditations. That's not the end of the path, but it tells you just what's more and puts things in perspective. And of course, that's a good description, the best we can probably do, trying to describe what we're doing here. But you know what it's like for many people who used to live in jail or couldn't go outside? Didn't know anything else except jail. When they were going to be released the next day, they were so scared, terrified. They knew how to deal with jail life in an institution. The idea of freedom was scary. So sometimes what we teach here will be scary. But have a look about the monks here. And the nun. It's nothing to be scared about at all. It's real freedom. Being free from things. That's why it's beautiful.